And just to clarify, these at-home test kits are actually test collection kits. So you just collect a sample with the nasal swab and then send that off to the lab to be tested.
And the reliability of this, we have 10 seconds.
Sure. So it's, you know, at this point it's pretty early, but we think that they are fairly reliable. But again, there's always a risk that if you're not swabbing correctly, maybe you would have a false negative.
Well, Tanya Lewis, I want to thank you for being with us, Associate Editor for Health and Medicine at Scientific American. We'll link to your piece. Here's what we know about the most touted drugs tested for COVID-19. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. I'm Amy Goodman. This is The Quarantine Report. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, distancing in Oregon has saved tens of thousands from coronavirus infection. Colorado and Nevada join the pact of Western states, agreeing to ease social distancing restrictions together. And in international news, New Zealand claims victory over COVID-19. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 27th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of this afternoon in Oregon, there have been 2,344 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state. A total of 92 people have died due to the novel coronavirus. The Oregon Health Authority reported one more death and 43 cases today. The person who died was a 91-year-old Washington County woman who had underlying medical conditions. So far, a total of 51,198 people in Oregon have been tested, with 95% of tests coming back negative. Colorado and Nevada have announced they are joining Oregon, Washington, and California in the Western States Pact to gradually lift stay-at-home orders. Nationally, at least 977,000 people across every state plus Washington, D.C., and four U.S. territories have tested positive for the novel coronavirus. The new death toll in the U.S. has officially passed 55,000. Across the globe, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 2.9 million people across 177 countries. As of Monday afternoon, at least 202,000 people have died. Oregon's aggressive social distancing measures may have averted thousands of COVID-19 cases. That's according to data released by state health officials on Friday. While exact numbers were unattainable, solid estimates say upwards of 70,000 coronavirus cases and roughly 1,500 hospitalizations have likely been avoided due to strict social distancing orders put in place last month. Oregon State Epidemiologist Dr. Dean Seidlinger said Friday that despite shortages of testing being available, quote, our collective efforts are working. Lives are being saved. The most recent projections of coronavirus cases in Oregon estimate that over 8,400 residents likely have the virus, though confirmed cases are currently just over 2,000. Many medical experts are now saying that many infected people don't show symptoms of the illness, making adherence to distancing and personal sanitation extra urgent. Despite the fact that estimations of the confirmed cases are far below initial expectations, the analysis also cites the crucial importance of maintaining distancing and shelter-in-place orders, and that we are not anywhere near ready to return to normal. New coronavirus testing guidelines were released Friday from the Oregon Health Authority, widening the eligibility pool for Oregonians seeking COVID-19 tests. Additionally, Governor Kate Brown announced a Hillsboro-based Walgreens would begin offering drive-through rapid tests for those meeting these new state guidelines. The governors of Colorado and Nevada announced Monday that their states will be joining the western states in a pact aimed at fighting the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Governor Jared Polis of Colorado and Governor Steve Sisolak of Colorado both made announcements Monday morning from their respective offices. Joining the ranks alongside Oregon, Washington, and California, the Western States Pact is a group of governors sharing hopes of modifying stay-at-home orders while maintaining vigilance against the spread of COVID-19. With a shared vision of employing health statistics and science-based information over politically driven motives, the group maintains that the health of its residents is the paramount concern. With consensus that a beginning of reopening will depend on decline of the spread of the virus, the pact hopes that together, with the addition of Colorado and Nevada, the states can set a metric to guide those steps. With adherence to principles agreed upon within the group, the roster of priorities cite the protection of vulnerable populations, the providing of adequate hospital care, and the mitigation of non-COVID health issues, especially those in disadvantaged communities, and systems of testing and tracking to protect the general public. Earlier this month, a similar pact was set up with northeastern states New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Partnerships between governors of Midwestern states, including Ohio, Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, Indiana, and Kentucky, were also established in recent weeks in efforts to help the nation reopen and get back on its feet. Oregon City Mayor Dan Holliday may face legal action if he reopens the city's businesses before Governor Kate Brown lifts the statewide stay-at-home order. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum sent a letter to Holliday on Friday, reminding the mayor that violating the stay-at-home order will result in legal penalties, and added, quote, "In addition to putting your residents' health at risk, you may be placing them in legal jeopardy." Holliday reportedly spoke to business owners and mayors across the state about the possibility of reopening businesses, but said he didn't have any solid plans. After a mayor's consortium meeting Thursday, Holliday said he decided he would abide by the governor's stay-at-home order. However, Holliday believes the state is moving too slowly to reopen businesses. He said, quote, "If hospitals are going back to work, I'm not sure why it is that restaurants and other small businesses can't be expected to open safely. I don't see the danger that we thought there was 4 or 5 weeks ago." New data from the Institute of Disease Modeling in Bellevue, Washington, showed that Oregon's stay-at-home measures have helped the state avoid over 50,000 infections, but loosening social distancing regulations too soon could still cause another spike in cases. Two grocers in the Portland metro area are now requiring their customers to wear face masks, a major step to protect frontline grocery workers. World Foods is the latest grocery store to announce face mask requirements along with New Seasons. New Seasons also added they will be providing face coverings for individuals who wish to shop but don't already have a face mask. These moves come just days after an employee of the Pearl District Whole Foods died from coronavirus. Both grocers, along with others in the Portland area, are providing sanitizing wipes and zoned structure within the store for proper social distancing, but that just isn't enough. Employees at both companies have been mandated to wear facial protection, but concern for their safety and fears around potential exposure abound. World Foods safety team leader Tyler Magyar told Coin, quote, "We have to look out for the health of our staff, and there is also a morale-boosting element to this over the last couple days. Even with some stores limiting the number of entrants at a time, keeping 6 feet apart from individual shopping remains a challenge." Both shoppers and employees of grocery stores have commented that this added health security measure may expedite the gradual lifting of stay-at-home orders. Despite stay-at-home orders keeping many drivers off the roads, Saturday afternoon saw a mile-long traffic jam inspired by steak. With food service industries hit hard by COVID-19, many restaurants and food carts have been offering discounted or even free food to a public largely shut indoors at home. Ringside Steakhouse got into the spirit of things over the weekend, offering a massive curbside steak sale near their West Burnside Street location. The frozen steak sale spawned a massive mile-long traffic jam, with hungry patrons clamoring for the cheap eats on Saturday afternoon. With intentions of providing the food in 2 6-hour shifts over the weekend, the restaurant sold out of the beef in just under 3 hours. TriMet officials reported the traffic chaos interfered with two bus lines, setting schedules already compromised into further delay. Ringside posted its sale menu on its Facebook page and asked customers to enter their parking lot on West Burnside, select from the menu, and wait in a parking space for the items to be brought to their car. With a growing throng of onlookers, police eventually stepped in to help direct traffic and appease disgruntled commuters caught up in the melee, with officers on foot urging pedestrians to continue about their business. According to some motorists that were in line Saturday, the rate of movement was less than 50 yards an hour, for a chance to obtain the State House's renowned dry-aged meat products. The decrease in youth detention rates over the last month has been as dramatic as the reduction rate from 2010 to 2017 at detention centers in 30 states. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story with the Public News Service.
The number of young people in detention centers has decreased dramatically since the coronavirus outbreak began, according to a new survey. NEE Casey Foundation data from centers in 30 states, including Washington, finds populations decreased by nearly one quarter in March. That's about the same decline that occurred in these states from 2010 to 2017. Chin Chin Jiang, staff attorney with Team Child in Seattle, says it shows a positive trend that locking young people up isn't the best way to make progress.
We think that this work shows that detention can be reduced. We can allow youth to be better supported and served in the community, and it actually will not increase crime or threaten the safety of our communities. It will actually do just the opposite.
The researchers note the data is significant, but only a snapshot of juvenile justice systems nationwide. Team Child says it's following the Washington figures, and in some counties, youth detention numbers have pretty much stayed the same. Nate Bayless heads the NEE Casey Foundation's Juvenile Justice Strategy Group. He says many young people are held in secure detention because they've broken rules of probation, committed a minor offense in the community, or been arrested at school.
All of these things end up being the reasons that systems sometimes use secure detention, even though the point should be one that's focused on community safety.
Executive Director of Team Child Annie Lee says the COVID-19 crisis has prompted Washington State to reassess how to reduce the risk of young people skipping their court dates or reoffending.
Those are the kinds of big systems changes that we could sustain after the quarantining is over, is to really rethink how we deploy our resources and to make sure that the kids are getting what they need and the families are getting what they need, rather than using detention as the default.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Plans to get rid of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar may be in the works, according to multiple White House sources. As tensions mount amid the ongoing coronavirus outbreak, friction between Azar and top administrative officials have reached a boiling point, as broad criticism has been directed towards the government's handling of COVID-19. Clashes between the secretary and President Trump have been evident in recent weeks, following the president's appointment of Vice President Pence to head the coronavirus response. Despite rampant criticism over the White House dropping the ball in its initial response to COVID-19, many accounts have painted Azar in a positive light and have noted his frustrations with communicating to Trump crucial information about the disease. Trump's move to appoint former campaign advisor Michael Caputo to top spokesperson of HHS has been regarded as a move to gain more control over the department, following complaints from the White House saying that Azar was pushing narratives on reporters. Azar has denied that. Further negative sentiment against Azar grew last week when vaccine expert Rick Bright was ousted for refusing to promote an unproven treatment touted by Trump. Though Azar called Bright's transfer a promotion, Bright cites the action as a retaliation for not going along with the president's highly critiqued public recommendations. Observers have named some potential replacements for Azar, like Medicare Chief Seema Verma, White House Coronavirus Coordinator Deborah Birx, and Deputy HHS Secretary Eric Hargan, though White House spokespeople have denied those speculations. The White House has fought back at these, quote, media-driven assumptions, calling them irresponsible and a distraction from the whole-of-government response to coronavirus, with HHS spokeswoman Caitlin Oakley saying Monday, quote, Secretary Azar is busy responding to a global public health crisis and doesn't have time for palace intrigue. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with former mayor and Portland City Council candidate Sam Adams, followed by another special report on how COVID-19 intersects with the overdose crisis. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, we'll hear Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with a high of 72. Today in history, in 1994, South Africa held its first multiracial elections. More than 22 million turned out to cast ballots, and an overwhelming majority chose anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela, who became the country's first black head of state. The quote of the day is from Mandela, who said, quote, "May your choices reflect your hopes, not your fears." Of San Juan, Puerto Rico, alleged over the weekend that none of the island's eligible residents have received their expected coronavirus stimulus payments from the federal government. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more on the story.
During an appearance on MSNBC, Carmen Yulin Cruz, mayor of the U.S. territory's capital city, said that citizens of Puerto Rico have not received any of the $1,200 stimulus checks that many Americans have already received as part of the government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Mayor Cruz speaks about her concerns.
No one in Puerto Rico has received the $1,200 from the federal government. We're having problems with the local $500 that the governor said that was going to distribute. There's more than 130,000 unemployment requests that have not been filled. The same thing with people getting food stamps. No requests for people getting food stamps.
That was San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz speaking on MSNBC. She claimed that the necessary support is being unevenly distributed, reaching higher levels of state government and failing to spread to the rest of the people. According to Francisco Perez, secretary at the Puerto Rico Treasury Department, the direct deposits will be given to some residents after the U.S. Treasury approves of Puerto Rico's distribution plan. According to the IRS, special rules apply to U.S. territories, and the payments are sent out through the territory's tax authorities. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
Two former health officials are leading a call for a $46 billion public health investment into a future coronavirus aid package to help safely reopen the economy. Andy Slavitt, former director of Medicare and Medicaid in the Obama administration, and Scott Gottlieb, a former Food and Drug Administration chief for President Trump, said that Congress needs to devote funding to help states find people who have been exposed to the virus and to offer resources to infected and exposed people who want to self-isolate. In a letter to House and Senate leaders, Slavitt, Gottlieb, and others wrote that, quote, "The existing public health system is currently capable of providing only a fraction of the contact tracing and voluntary self-isolation capacity required to meet the COVID-19 challenge." The officials urged that testing availability and accuracy needs to be improved and noted that the last aid package, signed into law on Friday, had $25 billion for testing. Now, they believe that more funding must be added to support states tracking and isolating infected people. After these complementary actions are implemented, the letter says, then the economy can begin to safely reopen. Slavitt added, quote, "Testing, complemented with a full contact tracing strategy, will allow states to prevent small campfires from becoming forest fires." Tomorrow is the Ohio primaries and Maryland's 7th District special election to replace the late Representative Elijah Cummings. With more on those stories, here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
If we are really determined to treat citizens with disabilities as equal citizens, accessibility can't be an either or. It has to be an and.
National Federation of the Blind's PR director Chris Danielson says any new election adaptations need to include everyone.
Unless you can independently mark a ballot, then by definition, at least one other person is going to know who you voted for.
Tomorrow's Ohio primaries and Maryland's special election to replace the late Representative Elijah Cummings. Both have tools so blind voters and those unable to write can fill out absentee ballots independently. It's important, Danielson points out, this is not online voting. It's a web-based tool to fill out a ballot before printing, signing, and mailing. He wants more states to use the system, but only a few have. New Mexico, Oregon, Colorado, and Montana. New Jersey's working on it.
We are all in favor of whatever measures need to be taken to make sure that we are safe and that poll workers are safe. I mean, I don't want to get coronavirus from a poll worker either. But at the same time, if you're going to have an election during this time, then it needs to be an election that everybody can participate in.
In Florida, the biggest swing state, the three most populous counties are promoting mail-in ballots for this year's elections. President Donald Trump voted absentee there recently, despite his unsubstantiated claims that voting by mail is, quote, corrupt. Former Vice President Joe Biden took a sharp attack against President Trump for opposing mail-in voting for partisan reasons and for the president's threats to block an emergency loan to the U.S. Postal Service, a critical piece of the vote-by-mail apparatus. Some White House sources, speaking to the Washington Post on condition of anonymity, link Trump's frequent criticism of the Postal Service to a desire to hurt one of their major customers, Amazon's Jeff Bezos. But expert witness in voting rights cases, University of North Carolina Charlotte Professor Theodore Arrington, thinks the $10 billion loan will come through.
Congress simply has to do that. There's going to be a big load on the Postal Service from this additional mail-in voting, and they're not equipped to handle it right now. They need an influx of cash.
So does Biden's campaign. They've joined up with the Democratic National Committee for the Biden Victory Fund, a common way of raising money once there's a party nominee. Trump has had a joint fund with the Republican National Committee since May 2016. Brendan Quinn from the Center for Responsive Politics says it's a major advantage,
which allows his campaign and the RNC to host a big fundraiser and allows donors to write one big check that gets divided between his campaign and the RNC rather than them having to go to separate fundraisers. So that's been very successful for both his campaign and the party.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at PacificaNetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the island nation has won the battle over COVID-19 as her government announced the lifting of most social distancing restrictions meant to stem the spread of the virus. Ardern said Monday, quote, "There is no widespread, undetected community transmission in New Zealand, but we must remain vigilant if we are to keep it that way." On April 5th, the first cases of COVID-19 were announced in New Zealand. New Zealand stay-at-home orders were put in place in late March, and there have been a total of 19 coronavirus deaths in the country. On Sunday, there were no new cases announced for the first time in weeks, but another 5 were reported on Monday, according to NPR. Ardern and Ashley Bloomfield, New Zealand's Director General of Health, said that declaring the virus eliminated did not mean there would be no new cases, but that the numbers would be more manageable. Now, most businesses are allowed to reopen, with the exception of businesses that require face-to-face contact, such as hairdressers and public gyms. Ardern said that aggressive contact tracing had been increased, and she believes this will help control the decreasing spread of coronavirus. The last coal-fired power plant in Sweden shut down this month, 2 years earlier than when the country originally pledged to go coal-free. KVV6, located in eastern Stockholm, was the last coal-fired cogeneration plant in Sweden and has shuttered its last boiler permanently after not being used over the last winter. Stockholm Exergi CEO Anders Egelrud said in a statement that over 30 years ago, Stockholm was fossil fuel dependent, so they have made significant changes, moving, quote, away from carbon dependence and continuing the journey toward an energy system entirely based on renewable and recycled energy. Egelrud said the region won't only focus on carbon-neutral energy, but that it also aims to be carbon-negative. Stockholm has a goal of achieving carbon neutrality by 2040. Closing the last coal plant will nearly halve the utility's emissions per year, according to themayor.eu. Belgium became the first EU country to phase out coal in 2016, and 6 more countries have pledged to follow that lead by 2025. Southern Ute tribe's stay-at-home order continues, even as Colorado loosens restrictions. New Mexico's governor said she will continue to advocate for resources for the Navajo Nation, and a native artist in South Dakota talks about the financial impacts of coronavirus. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The chair of the Southern Ute Indian Tribe says the tribe's emergency stay-at-home order will continue to remain in place as the state of Colorado loosens COVID-19 orders this week. Southern Ute Chairman Christine Sage, in a video message to tribal members last week, says the tribe is exercising its sovereignty.
The Southern Ute Indian Tribe will continue with its stay-at-home order issued on March 25, 2020. Again, the tribal stay-at-home order remains in effect.
Sage is urging citizens to practice social distancing and other safety and health measures to slow the spread of COVID-19. The state of Colorado began its Safer at Home phase Monday, which encourages residents to stay at home as much as possible, but is not required. New Mexico's governor says she'll continue to work with the Navajo Nation and advocate for funding and resources for the tribe to respond to COVID-19. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham spoke during a virtual town hall with Navajo leaders Sunday, urging for emergency measures to continue to slow the spread of COVID-19.
We're going to have to figure out additional strategies that bring food, water, necessary supplies, elevate the issues, just as you, Mr. President and Vice President, have identified for both the White House and Congress and every governor, which is we've got to solidify and double down our efforts to solve community problems that are more than 100 years old, and we have yet to really get together and get the federal government to meet its trust responsibility by having states say that that's also their priority.
Lujan Grisham also expressed her displeasure of the federal response to help the tribe, saying it's waited too long to get much-needed resources to the Navajo Nation, and she vows to advocate for the tribe to the White House. New Mexico's continuing its stay-at-home order as well as the Navajo Nation. Over the weekend, the number of positive cases on the Navajo Nation reached 1,716 and 59 deaths. A Native artist in South Dakota says she depends on markets and events to sell work, which is being impacted by COVID-19. China Lockett has more.
Lorianne Tubles paints colorful images of women, animals, and geometric shapes with touches of gold metallics and gemstones. She uses canvas or creates wearables from organic materials. Tubles sets up booths year-round at events and art markets, but now her income is at risk because of efforts to reduce the spread of the coronavirus, which causes COVID-19.
And I do have businesses that I do sell to, so it's had a ripple effect on me because they're not able to buy right now because nobody is going into their store. And the tourists aren't out and about like they usually are about right now.
Tubles is 59 and a cancer survivor, so even colds take a toll on her health. Social isolation is important for her to stay healthy right now.
If I get this, you know, virus, COVID-19, I don't think I could survive that. I don't want to sound all grim and doom, but let's get real here, you know. I'm not panicking, but at the same time, I'm educating myself about it.
She's able to order some supplies online, but is sticking to the necessities to save money. Tubles decided this is a good time to create a website and build her online presence to try and keep her business running.
Basically, right now, I'm just building up inventory and just sort of living off of my savings. It's not that big of a savings account, but kind of getting worried about that. Because I have bills to pay.
Other South Dakota artists and organizers are in discussion, coming up with ways to help creators sustain themselves during the pandemic. For National Native News, I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 27th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Melissa Hood and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host D. May Roberts presents the final episode of the documentary series Indigify, Definition of Resilience, about Indigenous hip-hop artists. Then at 11:30, Art Focus host Joseph Gallivan interviews art collector Ninjis in her home in Portland. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by listener support. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
KBOO's Yasmin Kobanoglu spoke with former mayor and current Portland City Council candidate Sam Adams about why he's running and what his priorities would be for Portland.
Sam Adams is running for Portland City Council position number 4. Adams was previously a member of the Portland City Council from 2005 to 2008 as Commissioner of Public Utilities, running the Portland Office of Transportation as well as the Bureau of Environmental Services. In 2009, Adams was elected as mayor of Portland and became the first openly gay mayor of a top 30 U.S. city. Since then, Adams has worked as executive director of the nonprofit organization City Club of Portland, and in 2014 became director of U.S. climate initiatives at the World Resources Institute. Thank you for talking with me today. First off, why are you running for Portland City Council?
Well, when I came back to Portland in May of last year, I felt firsthand what I had been sort of observing from afar during my work in Washington, D.C., heading up the U.S. program for an environmental think tank. What I've found is that many of the challenges that Portland faced were getting beyond our reach, or getting close to being beyond our reach to tackle, to make serious progress on. And that concerned me. And also the sense from Portlanders of all walks of life that their connection, their sense of connection was frayed or broken when it came to City Hall. And what really alarmed me and caused me to put my hat in the ring was this growing acceptance that, you know, maybe we can't, you know, make big changes, big improvements in like houselessness and homelessness and, you know, transportation, pollution, congestion and safety. And I just, we can make great strides on those issues. And Portland is the kind of city that doesn't give up on trying to solve problems that other cities have long ago sort of shrugged their shoulders and gave up on. And so I'm running as someone who has, you know, hands-on experience taking on tough issues, even, you know, Willamette Week, who's, you know, not exactly been a friend of mine over the years, said even his toughest critics say he was an accomplished mayor. And in addition to my experience, I also, working for World Resources Institute Environmental Think Tank, had the opportunity through that work to travel the world and the United States and see how other cities are, you know, tackling their problems. So I bring back that sort of fresh eyes and new thinking and inspiration from other places, along with, you know, my experience. And we're now headed in the, you know, we're in a very deep economic recession right now, and people that were living on the edge, you know, are really being pushed over the cliff by, you know, the high job loss, businesses that are closed. And, you know, I was mayor during the Great Recession and led the city from being one of the hardest hits in that 2008 recession to be one of the fastest locales to recover. So, and we did that with, you know, innovative programs like fast-tracking already funded city construction projects worth hundreds of millions of dollars to keep people working. I overcut the city's budget so that I could increase funding for, you know, homelessness and keep people, rent vouchers, keep people in their homes, 30% increase in general fund funding, $42 million over 4 years, and had the city approval, got approval of the city's first neighborhood economic development strategy and implemented the Neighborhood Prosperity Network and the Portland Seed Fund to help, businesses in the poorest main streets in Portland and to help startup businesses with the unique public-private partnership. So I bring all that to my run for city council. I would bring that to the city council if I get elected.
And what would your priorities be in this position specifically?
Housing, jobs, those are my priorities. Housing because it's the inaffordability of housing and the lack of, you know, I think there's well-intentioned, don't get me wrong, people working on this issue, and some great work has been done, but, there's room for much improvement. You know, for example, the city council in 2015 declared an emergency around houselessness and affordable housing, but I don't think they've really acted on it besides investing some money into the Joint Office of Homeless Services, which I support that investment, and I support the Joint Office of Housing Services that the city and the county, along with Metro, formed. That's the right approach. But, you know, name for me the city's coordinator on houselessness. You can't, because there isn't one. If people fully embraced, as I do anyway, that this is an emergency to be a better partner with the county and Metro, you know, we need to have a homelessness coordinator in the city. Where's the weekly meeting of all the bureaus siloed in the commission form of government that are meeting to be proactive on issues, to address issues both for those that are suffering from homelessness, but also those that are impacted by homeless camps? It's not an either or, it's both. We got to take care of both constituencies. And you just can't do that unless you're coordinated. So the existing money that's going to it, I think, can be more effectively deployed. I think it can be more effectively planned. I'm not even sure that there is a summer strategy for houselessness. And we see a big increase in houselessness and a big increase in complaints during the summer months. So we need to be on top of this better than we are. On jobs, it's going to be a twisting path forward through COVID-19 until this federal government, who is really just bungled in so many ways, obviously preparation and now dealing with the issue itself with Trump asking people to resist the stay-at-home orders of their governors. I mean, this is as irresponsible as, you know, one could possibly imagine. So it's going to be a twisting road up front. I think there are, at the moment, while we're sheltering in place, governments that work in the city of Portland are making big cuts to their budgets because of declining revenues. But my pitch to them is, don't make it alone in your silos. You know, and there are 26 independently operated governments in the 149 square miles that is the city of Portland. City government is just one of those. You know, that's government spending in the city, it depends on how you count it, is between $11 and $18 billion. The city of Portland is about $5.5 billion. So, you know, take for example transportation, the bureau that I used to be the commissioner in charge of for 8 years. And I did this when I was on the city council and transportation commissioner, because I was cutting the bureau's budget 8 years in a row because of declining gas tax and vehicle registration fees. I would have the bureau sit down with all the other transit and mobility providers in the city of Portland And we would, before we finalized our budgets, we would compare and we would work to coordinate. If everybody's that provides transit, transportation, mobility, services, enforcement, maintenance, if they're all cutting their budgets in their own little silos, it's we, the public, that are going to pay the price for that dysfunctional approach. So we need to have jurisdictions that work in the city of Portland. The city of Portland needs to convene those folks and compare notes and coordinate budget cuts, not just to preserve services, which are important, especially services for those in the greatest need for affordable and safe transportation services, you know, but to preserve as much of those frontline services as possible.
And what do you see right now as the biggest problem facing Portlanders?
The economy, joblessness, businesses that are at the brink of failing, the lack of income for workers and families that threatens, you know, an exponential increase in homelessness. The economic insecurity wrought by the pandemic and all of its impacts and ripples through people's lives is profound. It puzzles me why, for example, you know, when this first was making its way to the United States, having worked through many disasters over my years in city government, knew that it would likely land here. But I still listen to people that are running for city council, even in my race, and this is reflected in like the voters pamphlet statements, that are talking about the critical issues we face without really factoring in any meaningful way the new realities on the ground. That's why, you know, I've really transformed much of my campaign into an advocacy campaign.
What would you say is the biggest lesson you learned during your time as mayor of Portland?
You know, when we went through the Portland plan, so the city of Portland, like most cities across the United States, didn't have a strategic plan, you know, and that probably rolls the eyes of a lot of people listening to it. Sounds very bureaucratic, but what it meant is that bureau managers, workers, city commissioners, you know, could get up in the morning and everyone had a different definition of what the future success of Portland should be. Didn't have agreed upon foundational commitments to equity and inclusion or sustainability. My former boss, Mayor Vera Katz, understood the need for this, maybe not media sexy, but how important it was that a $5.5 billion public enterprise, you know, like the city of Portland, knew what its goals were and where it wanted and how it, you know, that its theory of change of how it was going to get there. So instead of just doing a plan for city government itself, the Portland plan, we really sought to involve those 26 layers of government that I mentioned earlier, so that we weren't just doing the much needed work of getting the siloed commission form of government sort of on the same page, but also to try to, we can't order them, but to try to empower, educate, and engage the other layers of government that work in the city of Portland, not only to solve problems, but to seize opportunities. And what I've learned through that process, and we had, I think, 12,000 resident or 12,000 inputs from people, dozens and dozens of meetings. We went out to groups where they met as opposed to expecting them to show up, met at neighborhoods, did a lot of outreach. And what I learned is it was something that people intuitively got, the importance of it, and that it was perceived as, you know, a basic requirement of government to have a plan so that they can judge their progress or lack of it, and others can, and also to remind themselves in times like this, especially while you're cutting budgets, let's say, that we still have to do everything we can to achieve the goals of what in the, you know, with a foundation of sustainability and equity, and the Portland plan's goals of educated, healthy, and prosperous. You know, it's 12 performance measures that are reported on, their action items in the midterm. So one of the biggest lessons I learned as I started, when we started out this project, I didn't think there'd be much interest, and I thought it would be derided. And there was sometimes a lack of interest and sometimes derided. But I was pleasantly surprised that people got how important it was that we've created for ourselves a roadmap of where we want to go. And, you know, now I support changing the commission form of government to a form of government that reflects, you know, more like Multnomah County's form of government, where you have an executive chair that could be the mayor, you have a chief operating officer at the county that could be a city manager. You have board members that are elected by district, so could the city council. Except I think, you know, we need more than five. So I think we have the example in Multnomah County. We have the Portland plan to guide our way. And I champion both of those together, in part because I've learned that people are really passionate about that they want us to have the basics done.
And how can our listeners find out more about your campaign?
Yeah, go to samadamspdx.com. Feel free to email me at sam@samforpdx.com, text me or call me on my cell phone at 503-421-8925. Again, give me your best ideas, critiques, questions. This campaign is a great opportunity for folks to put their interests forward.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today. That was Sam Adams, Portland City Council candidate for position number 4. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu with the KBOO Evening News.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had disparate impacts on people of different groups. One such group are those affected by the opioid crisis, who face increased accessibility issues during closures related to the pandemic. Social distancing can make it harder for them to prevent overdoses. I spoke to Dr. Sheila Vicaria, who is the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance, to learn more.
So you work at the Drug Policy Alliance. What have you seen to be the relationship between the coronavirus outbreak and the overdose crisis?
What we're starting to see on the ground and what we've been hearing from folks is that the very conditions that have created the situation that we're in terms of the overdose crisis, the structural and social and policy challenges that have led to rising inequality, lack of access to health care, lack of access to housing, mass criminalization, and mass incarceration, those very same challenges that are fueling the overdose crisis are in a lot of ways the same exact challenges that are also fueling the harms associated with the COVID pandemic right now. And unfortunately, a lot of the same communities that are being marginalized by the very policies that are putting them at risk for overdose are going to be experiencing even more risk to their health and well-being because they're also at risk for COVID-19.
So specifically, what are those contributing factors?
Sure. So one of the things that we know that drives overdose risk is using alone or using and not having someone around who can respond with naloxone or Narcan, or not being able to call 911. And what we know is that good overdose prevention education in communities tells people always have a buddy, always make sure to have naloxone on hand, and you know, if you're concerned about someone's well-being, call 911 to get help. And what we're seeing is that in light of COVID-19, what we've been recommending to folks, unfortunately, while it's good for prevention of COVID-19 exposure or transmission, is going to be putting folks at risk for overdose because we're encouraging folks to socially distance, which may mean isolating from others so that people are actually perhaps using alone. It may mean that the very programs that are distributing naloxone and sterile syringes are now limiting their hours and exposure so that people are less likely to have naloxone on hand when they do need it. And that it also means that 911 and emergency response has to rightly prioritize potential people who are struggling with COVID infection. And so it may mean that those who are calling with other medical emergencies may have delayed response times, which can actually mean the difference between life and death in the case of an overdose.
Right. And you spoke to this a little bit, but how does that limitation on non-essential medical treatments impact things like the overdose crisis?
Well, it differs from state to state in terms of whether, you know, harm reduction services such as syringe service programs that often distribute sterile equipment and naloxone are able to stay open or not. And it can differentially impact people in states where, unfortunately, those programs are deemed non-essential, so that people may now all of a sudden go from having access to not having access at all. But even in states where we know that syringe service programs and harm reduction programs are deemed essential, we are still seeing that these programs are having to adapt to the risk environment that they're in, and that they're having to modify their service structure, they're modifying their schedules, they're perhaps not open during all of the same hours or all the same days or in the ways that they were before, which means that at the end of the day, that the folks using those services are going to be most at risk for not being equipped to protect themselves and take care of themselves. That's kind of one of the challenges that we're facing, is that whether they're deemed essential or not, can mean that people may or may not have access. But even in states where they are deemed essential, unfortunately, they're still not functioning at the full capacity that they were pre-COVID.
Right. You know, according to the Oregon Health Authority, an average of 5 people in Oregon die per week from opioid overdose. And that's, you know, outside of the coronavirus outbreak. So sure. Given the constraints of the COVID-19 pandemic, what can health officials and policymakers do to better respond?
So there are some policies that have been changing at the federal level, which are heartening and potentially can do a lot of good. You know, one of the things that we do know to help prevent opioid overdose and reduce the risk of lethal overdose is getting people who have opioid use disorders access to evidence-based medications such as methadone and buprenorphine. And prior to COVID-19, policies were incredibly restrictive, and some would argue that they still are today. That only certain licensed prescribers can prescribe buprenorphine, that you could only get methadone by visiting your clinic daily, that you had to be initiated onto these medications through in-person consults, that oftentimes there's a counseling requirement that requires you to show up in person. And a lot of these barriers can actually restrict access and have still continued to drive overdose deaths before COVID-19, but are now risk factors for putting people in situations where they're going to be congregating and going to treatment providers. And so SAMHSA, the DEA, several larger federal governing bodies recently just changed some guidelines to make it easier for people to get onto these medications and for those who are currently taking these medications to stay on them. So one thing that's been positive that's rolled out is loosening the number of days that people have to come in to get dosed on methadone and allowing people to get up to 14 days of take-home medications, if not upwards of 28 days to take home. And we know that the more you can stockpile on your medications and not have to go in to get your medications at your pharmacy or at your clinic, the more likely you are to reduce those exposure points where you might be congregating and perhaps getting exposed to COVID-19. And so, you know, one thing that states can do and places like Oregon can do is ensure that methadone clinics and buprenorphine providers are fully taking advantage of these loosened restrictions so that clinics are, to the maximum extent possible, allowing these take-homes up to 14, if not 28 days. Because what we're hearing is also, unfortunately, across the country, even though these larger federal guidelines have changed state to state, but even within states, at clinic to clinic, some of these policies aren't really being implemented to the fullest extent they could be. And what ends up happening is that it still means that people who are trying to get on these medications and stay on these medications, which can reduce the risk of lethal overdose by 50%, are unfortunately still being subjected to having to go into programs where they might be exposed to the virus. So, you know, doing whatever we can at the city and the state level, but also on the clinic level, to make it easier for people to get on these medications is a huge step in the right direction to address the overdose crisis and to continue to try to do the best that you can. The other thing that we need to consider is that even in light of restricted potential hours of syringe service programs, how do we develop novel strategies, perhaps mail-based strategies, to send people injecting equipment, but also naloxone, to their homes directly? And we've been hearing some really promising stories coming out of states like New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio with mail-based naloxone access, really making it so that people don't have to leave their homes to get this medication, so that they can potentially reverse an overdose in case they witness one. So like policies like that can be really, really helpful in terms of reducing the risk of overdose.
Yeah, expanding what that idea of access looks like. So obviously those you know, the restrictions that we would deal with in a normal time, those are based on a certain, I don't know, view of, you know, opioid use. Do you think that that is changing at all, or that, you know, the idea of what is accessible enough will change?
We really hope so. I think, you know, so much of the restrictions around these medications were grounded in fears of, you know, illicit diversion of these medications, or fears that people couldn't be trusted to take home their doses without overindulging. And really, I think a lot of those fears have not been grounded in the reality of so many people who take these medications dutifully every day, who just want to be well, who just want to be able to do the things that they want to do in their day-to-day lives without feeling restricted by, you know, having to report back to a program. So, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, a decade-long overdose crisis didn't drive these policy changes in medication access, but it had to take a pandemic to do so. And there's many of us on the ground who are saying, you know, perhaps even these policy changes were a decade too late, but we're grateful to see them now. And sure, that hopefully what we'll see is that it'll end up saving a lot more lives during this crisis, and that we'll learn our lessons, that patients can be trusted with their medications, and that, you know, the sky didn't fall when we loosened these restrictions, and perhaps this means that we need to change business as usual. Absolutely.
So what is one thing that you think is maybe misunderstood about the overdose crisis and how it intersects with coronavirus?
I think that people often forget that many people who use drugs are very much the same exact populations who we should be concerned about, who have those very high risk factors that we've been talking about in terms of the populations that we should be protecting. A significant number of people who currently use drugs often do have co-occurring physical health challenges, if not are immunocompromised. And these are the exact people who we've been saying from the beginning need to be afforded more protections and more allowances to be able to reduce their exposure to this virus. And so when we think about COVID prevention and we talk about sheltering in place, for instance, we have to remember that a significant portion of people who are homeless or unstably housed are often also people who use drugs and who are often also people who are immunocompromised. And so when we think about even, in, you know, simple suggestions or seemingly simple suggestions like shelter in place, some of those very same guidelines are actually not feasible for some of the most marginalized people in our communities. And so we need to think of novel strategies, right? And so there are cities across the country that are having real and frank conversations. You know, how do we allocate, you know, vacant hotel rooms to the most at risk in our communities? Because even shelters and expanding shelters will not be the solution if people are still forced to congregate and can still be breathing in the same air as one another, right? So we need to remember that, you know, certain guidelines that we've made still may not be feasible for all people. And how do we make sure that when we make these guidelines that we truly are protecting the health of everyone? You know, and so when I gave the example of access to these medications, you know, one of the biggest messages that we've been sending to everyone with complicated health problems for which they're receiving medications is, you know, try to get the maximum amount of your prescription available so that you can reduce your time going back to the pharmacy. And unfortunately, we've forgotten the fact that the one medication that we actually say saves lives of people with opioid use disorder is one of the only medications for which you actually have to continue to go back several times a week to get, right? So, you know, remembering that, you know, certain policies may have to look different, or we might need to adapt our policy recommendations, or at least acknowledge that other groups are going to need more support to even engage in some of these practices that we want to do to help them stay safe.
Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners before we wrap up?
You know, I think that we as an organization, the Drug Policy Alliance, are really trying to advocate for policies that we know will help promote the public health more broadly, but particularly among people who use drugs. And one of the things that we're doing in the state of Oregon that I think is really exciting is that we are supporting ballot initiative IP44 in Oregon right now, and are hoping that in November we'll get on the ballot an initiative to reduce the punishment of people who use drugs and actually increase access to treatment and keep people out of jails who actually really need help. And I think if your callers are interested in learning more about how to support people who use drugs and getting them access to the services that they need and making sure not to fill up our jails and our prisons with people who use drugs who could probably benefit from being part of the community, I'd recommend them look into it. And they can get more information at yesonip44.org. We still need 8,000 more signatures to be able to make it to the November ballot, and we'd really appreciate the support of Oregonians on this.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Vicaria, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We have been speaking with Dr. Sheila Vicaria, the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance. More information on Initiative Proposal 44 is available online at yesonip44.org. More information on the Drug Policy Alliance is available at drugpolicy.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Join KBOO this Friday, May 1st at 11 a.m. for KBOO's first online live webinar and Q&A. The subject is COVID-19 in Palestine and Israel. We will hear from guest speakers like Dr. Osama Tenos, a pediatrician.